Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Storytime Stories when we come back. Hey, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce, and government gets 60%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year. And you're going to net about 25%, and the government will get 75%. So for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you net $4,000 more, about 8% more. You work twice as hard, you get 8% more. Take-home pay, guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. Now, that's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order our free general law CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little in return. Let me show you how to do just that in our Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult home study. To order your free general law CD package, just call direct and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967, or you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, our Tax and Status School is also available on compact disc for adult home schooling, and you can call direct, 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget? Story time. This is the time that we take and we set aside to tell you these stories that happen to real people just like you and me out there in the real world. Here in Gainesville, Missouri in 1980, we did not have a sewer and water district. Can you believe that? 1980. Modern times. No sewer, no water district. Everybody in the little town of Gainesville had a well, or they shared a well with a neighbor, or they had a septic tank or an outhouse, or they took care of their potty needs by themselves on their own property, one way or another. No sewer, no water district. Some blue suede shoe salesman blows into town one day, about 1980, and he says, "You know what you people in Gainesville need? You need a sewer and water district like all the countries, like all the cities around you." And so they called meetings, and the city council got together, and they talked about how we could get a sewer and water district. And then the bottom line was, very simple, all you have to do is vote in a bond issue. Bond issue. You know what a bond issue is? What does a bond issue do? How does it work? Why does it work that way? When you went to school, did anybody teach you about bond issues? I never heard a word about a bond issue when I was a kid in school. Not a word. Well, a bond issue is a debt that you subscribe to in order to buy some public works. You want to build a new school, you have a bond issue. You want to build a sewer and water district, you put in a bond issue. It's a mystery. It's like going to church. It's like catechism. Nobody really understands what the hell's going on here, but everybody does it. We get out and vote yes on Proposition A, or vote no on Proposition D. And so people, they watch these 30-second sound bites on television, make up their minds, and they go out and vote. And that vote, once it's passed, once it's accepted, has some economic consequences that the average Joe Sixpack, I don't think, understands. Well, here's an article in the Ozark County Times. It says, practically no one in Gainesville is happy over the new sewer bills, it seems, despite the fact that they cheerfully went to the polls in October of 1980 and authorized monthly charges to pay their share of the $2.5 million sewer system just completed here. Now the time has come for the bill to go out, and the city has been deluged with questions about the tab. This week, City Clerk Velma Hamilton released figures that she hopes will explain the matter. Every household and business in Gainesville must pay a basic charge of $5.67 a month. To this basic fee is added a charge of $1.90 for every 1,000 gallons of water that the household used in an average low month. To arrive at this add-on charge, the city averaged the water consumption for the months of January, February, and March of 1986. These are the 3 months of minimum water consumption. For households that have no water meters or that have private wells or that weren't occupied in the first 3 months, the average for all customers in the city was used as 3,500 gallons. Other households, those that have water readings for the first 3 months, are charged for their own average. Now, the sewer charges are figured to cover the cost of operating the system plus retire the $250,000 worth of revenue bonds that were authorized by the voters. These bonds provided the city's portion of the sewer construction cost. They'll be paid off in 35 years. 35-year bond issue. $250,000 bond. Oh, but that's only the beginning of it. That isn't the whole bill, and the people never understood what they were voting for. So let's see if we can understand what a bond issue is. The salesman comes in and he says, look, what you people need here is a new school. You need a new sewer water district. You need, or you deserve. And all you have to do is to vote this bond issue in, and the federal government will guarantee 90% of it. And right away, when the salesman says, and the federal government will guarantee 90% of it, the average Joe Sixpack says, oh, my gosh, the federal government's going to pay 90% of the cost. And then I only have to pay 10%. So what he's thinking in his greedy little heart is that if I vote this water sewer district in, I pay 10 cents on the dollar, and the people of Galveston, Texas, and Fort Worth, and Houston, and Los Angeles, and Boston get to pay for the other 90%. And boy, that appeals to my lust and greed. I can't think of anybody more deserving of a sewer and water district at the expense of the federal taxpayers than Joe Sixpack in Gainesville, Missouri. So they voted it in. It's a psychological ploy. That's what that is. Because, boys and girls, the federal government never pays 5 cents, not a nickel, for the construction or the operation or the installation of the sewer water district. The people of Gainesville are going to pay 100% of the costs, plus the bond rate interest for 35 years. So they're going to vote in a $2.5 million bond issue, and they think they're going to get it for $250,000. They're not. It's going to cost them $5 million plus. Now, the people of Gainesville incorporated their city in 1840. So from 1840 to 1980, 140 years, they had lived their lives, believe it or not, backward, uncivilized animals though they may have been, without any water sewer district. 140 years. The people of Gainesville never paid the city or a bond-holding company a nickel's worth of interest, never bought a gallon of water, or paid for one turd to be floated down the local creek. Now, after 1986, took them a few years to get this thing installed. Once they got the thing put in there, they find out that they've got a water bill every month and a sewer bill every month, which is probably cheap. I'm not here criticizing the good people of Gainesville for voting it in. And probably, if you want to be modern, chic, and up-to-date, you probably ought to have an inside toilet. Now, I've got inside plumbing, and I don't belong to a sewer water district. And the people of Gainesville, I'll just bet you that every one of them had an inside toilet, not a one of them belonged to any sewer water district prior to 1980. But now they do. And for the $15 a month that it probably costs them to operate this thing, it's probably money well spent. But there's a handicap. There's a little side story here. The rather innocuous article in the paper explaining why the Gainesville water bills went up, two deceptions are being played. It hides two deceptions being played on the people by government. Let's examine these two deceptions and show you how these frauds are perpetrated. Gainesville, at the time of the article, had just built a new sewer system costing $2.5 million. The federal government stepped in with a $2,250,000 guarantee to the insurance company and asked Gainesville, as per the government auditing schemes, to pony up $250,000 for their share of the system. So they responded with a $250,000 revenue bond issue to be paid off over 35 years. Now, Gainesville has a population of 700 people, out of which you have about 200 households, paying base water rates of $5.67 a month, in addition to $1.90 for 1,000 gallons of water, as the $1.90 for 1,000 gallons of water is for operating expenses of both the water and sewer systems. We'll just leave it for the moment. This leaves us with $5.67 a month per subscriber. Gainesville has $1,134 a month coming in from this base rate to pay off the issue. With 35 years to go, Gainesville should collect about $476,280 to pay off the bond issue and provide for any major work that needs to be done on the plant. Now, if you figure that they need an average of $5,000 to fix the plant per year, that still leaves over $300,000 to pay off a $250,000 bond issue. That's a return of 1.2 times your money over 35 years. Now, the problem with the above scenario is that the figures aren't what they really should be. First of all, inflation will drive that base cost up, especially over 35 years. And second, the population will grow, thus growing or throwing the above figures so far out of whack as to be unusable. The real figures, or a good approximation thereof, would be something like this. First, we'll limit the changes to hunks of 5 years so that we won't have to worry about yearly fluctuations and so that we'll have a manageable number of computations to worry about. Second, let's assume a constant growth and inflation curve. While these are both somewhat subjective and unrealistic, we'll be using figures on the low end of what we should expect, so the real return should be even higher. Now, figuring that Gainesville will grow at around 5% every 10 years, which is not an unreasonable figure, and that inflation stays at 2% every year, like the good old days, here's what we find the changes that will have to be made. The first 5 years, Gainesville has 200 customers paying $5.67 a month, and this means that the total for years 1 through 5 is $68,040. The next 5 years has Gainesville with 205 customers paying $6.26 a month. That means that the total for years 6 through 10 is $76,998. the third 5 years, fourth 5 years, fifth 5 years, sixth 5 years, and the seventh 5 years, the last, we figure Gainesville has 230 customers paying $10.25 a month, and that means that the total for years 31 to 35 is $141,450. Now, the total collected for the payment of the bond issue and the repair fund is not $476,280, but it would be closer to $708,000. And assuming the same $5,000 a year put aside for repairs, this would leave $533,000 to pay off the $250,000 bond. That means that whoever bought that bond would get back $2 for every one they invested, not just $1.20 for every dollar invested. This means that bond issues are a very good deal for insurance companies who watch as the people of a town mortgage everything in that town for 35 years for either a guaranteed 2-to-1 or better profit, or the town itself, if it defaults, then they take over all of the pledged assets of the city. Did you know that your house was a guaranteed asset of the city once you voted in the bond issue? Now, the second fraud is the one that received only about four lines in the whole article. Where did the other $2.25 million come from? Well, they tell us it came from the feds, of course. What this amounts to is that the feds go to California and tax them $2.25 million and then turn around and tell Gainesville, Missouri, hey, you too can have a good sewer water system with this free money. Later, they tax Missouri some $2 million and tell some small town in Vermont the same thing, and this vicious cycle just keeps on going. And every town believes that it's getting a new sewer system for only 10 cents on the dollar. And each town doesn't realize that it's paying for somebody else's sewer system thousands of miles away. Now, let's look at the protocol on land and land ownership and notice that if it feels that the Jews must deprive the Gentiles of their land, this is why. There are no allodial titles left in America today. Now, let's back up and think about this. The suede shoe salesman blows into Gainesville. He says, hey, listen, let's get the people of Texas to buy your system. You put up 10%, the people of Texas are going to put up the rest. Where in the hell did the federal government get the balance of that money? Okay, they had to tax everybody in the country to come up with the money. Aren't you one of the taxpayers of the country? And they're out doing this to every little town and hamlet in the country. And they've got the people of Gainesville buying the sewer water district for the people in California, and the people in California buying the sewer water district for the people in Vermont, and the people in Vermont buying the sewer water district for the people in Florida, and so on around the horn. Has anybody else woke up to the fact that the government doesn't have any money until they first take it from you? So why in hell didn't you people in Gainesville just buy and build your own? And you people in Vermont, just buy and build your own. Why the charade? Because the charade would come right home to roost if they came to you and said, we want to tax you $5 million. Get this. You're not paying $2.5 million for the thing over 35 years. You're paying at least two and sometimes three times for that. This sewer water district isn't going to cost you $2.5 million. It's going to cost you $5 or $7.5 million, depending upon inflation, depending upon the interest rate. Now, this is good business for government. I don't deny that. Hell, that's good. And it's good for insurance companies, and I don't deny that. And hell, who would want to deny the insurance companies a means of making a living? Now, let me show you here the protocol. It's called the Sixth Protocol of the Learned Elders of Zion. Let's see, why do we have this process going on around us? It says here, we shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall together with the government credit on the day following the political catastrophe. The economists here present must carefully weigh the significance of this combination, and we must develop by every means the importance of our super government, representing it as the protector and the benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. The aristocracy of the Gentiles as a political force has passed away, and we need not take them into consideration. But as owners of the land, they are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. And the best means to attain this is to increase the taxes and the mortgage indebtedness. These measures will keep landowners and land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. Unable to satisfy their needs by small inheritances, the aristocrats among the Gentiles will burn themselves out rapidly. And at the same time, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation. The function of speculation is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by land banks. Therefore, it is necessary for industry to deplete the land of both laborers and capital, and through speculations, transfer all of the money of the world into our hands, thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. And the Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. Now take a look at America today and take a look at your property taxes and take a look at your mortgage indebtedness. And then ask yourself, have these people already succeeded in their goal? They have succeeded in spades. And that's why you have the foreclosure collapse that's going on, not just in America, but worldwide. And why the world's economy is collapsing before your very eyeballs. History is being made today. So that's why they're out here trying to get you to join the sewer water district or the LID or to vote in a new school bond issue or. It's to put you into debt and to put you into perpetual credit debt serfdom or bond servitude forever. Now, there's a corollary story that goes along with this. Let me tell you this story. It's in South Tucson, Arizona. South Tucson, Arizona is a little bedroom community of the big city. And one day, they had a policeman who was injured in some fashion. And he sued the city and won a judgment of some $3 million. Now, the city fathers in South Tucson, Arizona, it's a corporation, you know, it's a municipal corporation. They took a look and they said, well, gee, we don't have $3.5 million to pay this guy. So, therefore, we should file for bankruptcy. So, they did. So, they went into federal court, filed for bankruptcy, and says, hey, listen, we got this humongous judgment against us for $3.5 million, and we can't pay it. So therefore, we should have it discharged in bankruptcy. So the bankruptcy judge takes a look at it and says, well, hold on here a minute, fellas. Let's think about this for a minute. Do you have any assets? And so the city father said, well, no, the city doesn't have any assets. And so the bankruptcy judge said, well, I think that you probably do. Let's think about this for a minute. And the judge suggested, do you have a city hall? Well, yeah, we got a city hall. Okay. Do you have a police station? Well, yeah, we've got a police station. Do you have any public schools? Well, yeah, we've got a couple of public schools. Well, do you have any city parks? Yep. Firehouses? Yep. Fire engines? Yep. Police cars? Yep. City automobiles, pickups, trucks, transportation trucks? Yep. Okay. Well, boys, those are all assets. So let's start by selling the city hall, police station, public schools, fire engines, and police cars, and let's see how much money we can come up with. Everybody was aghast at the suggestion. And the federal bankruptcy judge says, boys, a corporation has assets. The city of South Tucson has real estate. It has tangible and intangible property and property rights. And those all have to be liquidated before we can talk about bankruptcy. You've got assets. We're going to sell them. But a final question came. The defendants then said, in this case the plaintiffs, because they're filing for bankruptcy, said, well, what if we sell the city hall, fire department, police department, public schools, public parks, fire engines, and police cars, and when we get all through, we still don't have enough money. Then what? Judge says, no problem. Then we will start selling the houses in the city, because every city taxpayer is a surety underwriter of the corporate debt with joint and several liability. Now, did you boys and girls hear that? Every one of you who lives in a city like Detroit, Michigan, or like Los Angeles, California, or New York City, where the city is operating deficits and has huge debts, and they can't pay those debts. Well, when they become insolvent, like New York City, or like South Tucson, Arizona, the first thing they'll do is they'll sell the city hall. That's what they did in East St. Louis, Illinois. They sold the city hall. It's privately owned, and the city rents it from the private owner. Same thing with the firehouses, police cars, fire trucks, city parks. They're owned by other people. Here in America, you'll find that the Chinese government and governments around the world own famous parks and pieces of real estate. You know, like Yellowstone and Yosemite? Those are called biospheres. Those have already been sold off for the debt. Ah, but the kicker is the surety underwriters. Now, in the book of Proverbs, six times, the creator of the universe says, you shall not go surety for somebody else. He says, don't let sleep come to your eyes if you have struck your hand as surety for your brother or somebody else. Been warned, been told, don't do that. Well, a bond issue is a surety underwriting scheme whereby you get to guarantee jointly and severally. Joint and several. Here's what that means. Five of us are going to sign a contract guaranteeing that somebody's going to get paid a certain amount of money. Five of the six people who signed the contract renege and don't pay. That means then that the entire debt has to be paid by you severally. Or jointly, that's all of you, or severally, that's any one of you, joint and several liability. And notice what the bankruptcy judge said in South Tucson, we will start selling the houses on the courthouse steps until we get enough money. That's all. That means that every house within the city limits of South Tucson, Arizona, then, becomes the surety guarantee for the debts that the city fathers have taken on, which have been sponsored by and guaranteed by the taxpayers who all voted for the bond issue. How do you like that? That's all William Bendix used to say. You know, what a revolting development this has turned out to be. All right, so there's the story of bonds and bond issues. Pretty sordid story, I'd say. Now, that takes us up here to about the halfway point, so let me give you a reminder here in the minute or two that we've got here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the law hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's eight schools in all. The law school is a private, non-profit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. You know, there's one more corollary to this thing of a bond issue. An old friend of mine, his name was Pat Connolly. Probably dead by now. I haven't heard from Pat for many years, but 30 years ago, when I was first starting out, I met Pat Connolly in Boise, Idaho. He was a retired printer. And he had a piece of property, a house and 7 acres, out on Eustick Road there in Boise. And one day he woke up and they were having a bond issue. And over the years, the building people, you know, the developers would go out and they'd buy 20 acres. And they'd put in a tract of houses. And then they'd go out and buy another 20 acres or a 200-acre farm or something, and they'd start putting in houses. Well, pretty soon, Pat Connolly is an island of 7 acres in the middle of this housing development. And, you know, the more houses you build, then the bigger the sewer has to be. So one day, they needed to put in a big sewer down Eustick Road, and old Pat's house, you know, was faced onto Eustick Road. It had 7 acres. And so here it is, right in front of his house, they're digging up the road, and they put in what they call an LID, a LID. And what that stands for is a limited improvement district. It's a little autonomous political entity that people vote in. They're asked by the county commissioners, would you like to have sidewalks on your street? And the people all say, oh, yeah, we'd like to have sidewalks. Well, would you like to have your street paved? Oh, yeah, we'd like to have pavement. And so they vote in another bond issue. Would you like to have lights out there on your streets? Oh, yeah, we'd like to have lights. And so they put in an LID for lights. And well, would you people like to have a public school? And, oh, yeah, the people, they all want a public school out there. And so they vote in this public school. And would you people like to have city water so you can have chlorine and fluoride? Oh, yes, we'd like to have chlorine and fluoride in our drinking water. Would you people like to have a sewer, take away all of your nasties and dispose of them properly? You know. Oh, yes, yes, we'd like to have a sewer district. And so you keep voting in, you know, all these bond issues. You know, when business is good and the economy is cooking, you know, the people just can't get enough of the good life, and so they keep voting all this in. Now, every year they get a tax statement, and then they just keep adding on, you know, it's a dollar here and a dollar there, and $2 here and $2 there, and nickel here and a nickel there, and pretty soon, like one guy I was talking to down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Was it Fort Lauderdale? I think that's it, Fort Lauderdale. And he had a house, three-bedroom house, had a swimming pool in the backyard. The only saving value about this three-bedroom frame house, sitting on a lot with a swimming pool in the backyard, nice house. I mean, it's not a piece of trash, nice house. He's paying $12,000 a year property tax. That's $1,000 a month. That was 30 years ago. 30 years ago, paying $12,000. He was an airline pilot, so he could afford to live there, and he could afford the $12,000 a year property tax. But that property tax goes to pay for all of those thingies, all of those freebies, you know, that you're voting in, like free public education for all children in public school. That's where the money comes from to pay for those things. So, Pat Connolly, you know, he doesn't want the sewer water district. He's got his own well. He's got 7 acres. He's got a septic tank. He doesn't want his 7 acres in this LID, but all of the neighbors have voted in, like it or lump it, voted it in. Isn't democracy wonderful? Now, fortunately, there's a check and balance here in our Constitution against majorities who are trying to take your property without condemnation and payment. Thank goodness we still have that. So, Pat Connolly got a letter in the mail one day, and it said, hey, it's going to cost you $330 to have an outfit come out here and hook you up to the sewer. So please remit your $330 check. So Pat Connolly wrote him a letter, and he said, well, I don't want to send you $330, and I don't want to sign up for your LID. And he got a letter back and said, well, too bad, the majority wins. And this was a majority vote, and the people said yay, and so you just have to go along whether you like it or not. And like it or lump it. So Pat wrote him another letter back and said, well, thank you very much, but I think I'll lump it. I don't want to participate. So see you around. So some years went by. Now, they kept sending him letters. I mean, they never came out and killed him. Nobody came out and knocked on the door and blew him away. Nobody came out and sold his property or took anything away from him. Everything went on. I think about 8 years went by, as I remember the story. And one day, a developer came over to Pat and offered him $10,000 an acre. Now, boys and girls, today, $10,000 an acre ain't a lot of money. But let me tell you, $10,000 an acre back around 1980 was a god-awful lot of money. Just add 130%. It'd be like maybe $25,000 or $30,000 an acre today for his 7 acres. Offered him $70,000. And it was such a good deal that Pat just couldn't pass it up. I mean, you know, an old man been toyed with by a Hollywood whore like that just couldn't handle it. And so he said, yeah, I'll sell. And they went to the closing. Well, at the closing, there was an $800 lien against Pat's property by the LID for the non-payment of his sewer and water tax. And it's true. It's true. Pat had never paid a dollar. He didn't hook up to the sewer district. And he never bought any water from them. But now they got a bill against him for $800 plus interest. Well, it was the amount of money, you know, monthly, the $5.67 a month plus $1.90 per 1,000 gallons every month times interest, you know, times, and, you know, it goes on for 8 years, and pretty soon there's an $800 bill there. Well, let me ask you, what would you do? You're sitting here at the closing, and there's a $70,000 check there, and you're going to score big. Would you squirrel a $70,000 deal over $800? Well, Pat Connolly did. He said, no, I don't want to sell my land for $69,200. I was offered $70,000, and I want $70,000, and if I don't get $70,000, then I ain't selling. So he just got up and walked out. So he went home, and he wrote a letter to the LID, and he said, you know, you people have caused me quite a damage here. I had a cashier's check sitting on the table with a contract, copies of which are enclosed for your reference, for $70,000. And you people squirreled my deal over $800. You put a lien on my property for $800, and you didn't have any right to do that. So Pat went down and he filed suit against the LID for $70,000 in actual damages and $70,000 in punitive damages. Now, this is because back in those days, this is in the early 80s, this is before the Haslett decision. Punitive damages were limited to 2 times the amount of the actual damages. So, Pat, being conservative now, he didn't sue for 2 times punitive. He just sued for actual damages and punitive damages of an actual amount. That's $140,000. Served it. And then he wrote the LID the following letter. He said, now, over the past 8 years, you people seem to think that you have a right to my property without eminent domain and without condemnation proceedings, without notice and opportunity to defend. And I want to let you know that I do not have any sewage. Now, sewage, boys and girls, is a hazardous waste. And it's like nuclear waste. You can't have that. And I don't know if you people are aware of this, but you know, if you're storing a bunch of nuclear waste out in your garage, that's against the law. You can't do that. Now, if you're putting sewage up in quart jars and storing those, you know, in your pantry, you can't do that. That's hazardous stuff. Don't do that. It has to be properly disposed of. So Pat Connolly wrote him a letter, says, I don't have any sewage, haven't had any sewage, and I don't intend to have any sewage, and I'm not going to give you my night soil without compensation. But he said, I do produce night soil here. Night soil, for all of you non-farmers, is human waste used for fertilizing plants. That's what they call it in China, night soil. You go potty in a chamber pot, and then you go out and put it on your cabbages. See, makes them grow good. So he pointed out that he produced X number of gallons of night soil, which he stores in an underground chamber, commonly known as a septic tank, for which he then uses it for fertilizing his 7-acre farm. And that he wanted it for his own use. He did not want to give it to the LID. But he said for $1.40 per gallon, he would enter into a long-term 30-year contract and supply them with approximately 100 gallons per day. Which 100 gallons a day at $1.40, that'd be about $140 a day. Let's multiply that out and see what the number works out to be. 140 times 365 days in a year would be $51,100 a year. So he said, now if you'll pay me $51,100 a year and then guarantee me a market times 30 years for a total of $1,533,000, I will hook up to the sewer district at my expense and sell you my night soil. The LID responded by saying he was insane. And after the case never went to trial, that's why you never find this kind of a case. You see, after this case was finally run through and qualified, then the LID made an out-of-court settlement. Now, we don't know what the out-of-court settlement was, but here's what the deal was. Remember that contractor that wanted to buy the 7 acres? He came back to Pat and he said, "Hey, listen, would you take the $70,000? And then Pat said, "Yep, if you pay me $70,000 now, we can talk turkey, but otherwise we ain't going to talk." Now, we don't know if the contractor paid that $800 or not. I doubt that he did. He didn't have any obligation to pay. He might have. I can't tell you. But I can tell you this, Pat Conley didn't pay it. Pat didn't pay it. And Pat got his full $70,000 check. This is why I say, who says you can't beat City Hall? Now, if you remember, a few weeks back, I did a series of programs here on property being the holy grail of law in Anglo-Saxon administration. Now, sewage is a toxic waste that you can't have, and it has to be disposed of properly. Night soil is property, and night soil comes under eminent domain, and night soil, eminent domain, and property have to be bought and paid for. So there's that story. So let me put Pat Connolly down here so I write that down in my notes. And night soil. And let me tell you one more quick story here about this thing of property in Springfield, Massachusetts. Springfield, Massachusetts had a city ordinance that says you can't grow weeds. Springfield, Mass. No weeds. Now, this guy had a lot next door to his house. Now, I don't know what his house looked like, but the description from the court records indicates that this guy had a normal run-of-the-mill house. No problem with his lawn, vegetation, plants, his ornaments or anything else. But the lot next door, he got a weed abatement notice from the city, and they said, "Hey, listen, you got weeds, and once those weeds get up over 8 inches, we're going to come out and cut those weeds, and then we're going to send you the bill." So he wrote him a letter right back. This is pretty important. When you get these kind of notices, you need to set up communication right away and give your adverse party notice of the defect in his claim. Now notice the city comes along and says, "Hey, you got these weeds growing over here on this vacant lot, you know, next door to your house." Now he owned that lot. Nobody's denying that. And it's true, there was vegetation which was 8 inches high or higher, which was not conventional. And so the city, using their weed abatement ordinance, sent the guy a letter and said, "Now you cut those, we'll give you a week. And if you don't cut those in a week, we're going to come out and do it." So he wrote him a letter right back and he said, no, don't do that. He said, "Now I don't want you to do that because I don't have any weeds out there. That's my natural landscaping. I spent a lot of money landscaping my lot next door to my house." And he described some of the plants that he had out there. Now, I can't pronounce the names of these, they got them in Italian or Latin, you know, they write them in Latin. And it's the names of plants. And he cited all of these grasses and legumes and multiflora rose and whatever else he had out there. I don't know what kind of plants he had growing out here, but he said this is all natural landscaping. And he said, "I water that every day." And so he did. From that point on, he went outside with his hose. He's out there watering his natural landscaping. Now, evidently, the city of Springfield didn't like his story, so he came out and cut it down one day. He comes back home from work, and oh, my God, can you believe it? And not only had they cut down all of his natural landscaping in his vacant lot next to his house, they'd been watering and sent him a letter and carefully told him by identifying the Latin names of many of the plants that he had out there in his natural landscape garden. But they sent him a bill. Can you believe it? They not only sent him a bill, but when he didn't pay it, they put a lien against his property. Can you believe that? So the guy could stand no more, so he sued him. He said, now listen. Well, in the opening rounds in the state courts of Massachusetts, he didn't get very far. They found him guilty, and they said, pay up. But the case finally went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when the Supreme Court got it, they reversed the case, and they said, now listen, this law is vague and ambiguous. It's vague and it's ambiguous in that it identifies weeds without specificity. For instance, you know, what may be a weed to you may be a very valuable flower. Now, when I look at an orchid, it's just a damn weed to me. And people spend a lot of money buying orchids. I was in a greenhouse the other day, I think it was over at Walmart, and looking at their weeds that they sell. And my wife buys weeds. I'm telling you, she just buys weeds and weeds and weeds. I've never seen a woman buy weeds like my wife. And she takes them out and plants them. Now, I've got some of those weeds out in the pasture, and I can't cut them off fast enough. I call them weeds. She calls them flowers, flora. And she spends a lot of money on it. You know, it's kind of subjective. So the word weeds in your city ordinance won't carry the day. So with specificity now, they've got to identify things, you know, like star thistle, multiflora rose, or something else that they're actually targeting that they don't want any of. So when you're thinking about the law, and as it relates to you, think in terms of property and property rights. Property and property rights. Because in the final analysis, this guy won. Now, I don't know what the money damages against the city were. I imagine they had to take the lien off, and I imagine they had to pay him a little something for coming out there and cutting off his weeds. Cutting off his natural landscaping. So tuck that one away in your heart. Natural Landscaping, Springfield, Massachusetts. Tell you a little bit something about that. Hey, I got about 6 or 8 minutes here. Let's tell you one more quick story here. I had a guy come in here one day from what's that town on the Gulf Coast of Florida now? That big town over there. Tampa, Florida. Well, he didn't live right there in Tampa, but he lived right there in the environs. And this guy was an engraver. And I thought this was a hell of a story. The engraver. This guy makes plates. I mean, this guy, he engraves plates. And primarily, he engraves plates for amusement parks. You know, where you stick 50 cents in and the Ten Commandments come out on a penny or something, you know, some slogan comes out on a penny you stick into the machine. He's the guy that makes those plates. Well, he used to have a lot of customers. And over the years, his customers, he kind of let them go by the wayside. Instead of 30 customers with 5 machines each, he opted for a big outfit in Boston, Massachusetts that had 15,000 machines. 15,000. Well, he came to school here one day, and we were chit-chatting, you know, about gold and silver and one thing. He said, you know, I wonder if that company that I'm working for here, he's an independent contractor now. He says, wonder if those guys would pay me in gold coin. So he wrote him a letter one day and he says, hey, I'd like to get paid in gold coin. I don't want to be paid in Federal Reserve notes, checks, and credit cards anymore. I'd like to get paid in real money. And so the company wrote him back a letter and said, no way, Jose, we're going to pay you in worthless Federal Reserve notes and you're going to like it or lump it. So he'd been to school here a couple, 3 times, and he happened to be up here in school one day. I don't know, went through tax and status and business and courtroom strategy and procedure, and I don't know. He was up here going to school, and then he said, now there's a trade fair down in Atlanta, Georgia, and on Friday, I'm going to leave here right after school, and I'm going to drive lickety-split directly from here to Atlanta, Georgia. And then I'm going to talk to these people Sunday morning here, which is the Sunday being the last day of the trade fair. And then I'm going to see if I can't get them to pay me in gold coin. And if they don't, then I'm going to give them notice that I'm going to quit. And I'm not going to make their dies anymore. And he said, I expect to be unemployed here very shortly. And I said, well, let me ask you this, Tom. How many engravers are there here in the country? I mean, is this something, an engraver? You know, just think about it. You just call job service and say, hey, send over 4 or 5 engravers today. I'd like to interview them. And he said, no. Engraving is a pretty specialized business. There's Tom in Seattle, and there's George in Los Angeles, and there's Sam in New York, and then there's me in Tampa. And I mean, this guy is naming these people by name. And I said, you know, it sounds like to me that it might be more difficult for them to find a replacement for you than you to find a replacement for their business. I said, I think I would speak from a position of strength. And so he called me that Sunday morning. He said, just had a meeting, and they told me in no uncertain terms that they were not going to pay me in gold coin, and that their business relationship with us was at an end. And so I said, you know, I'm really surprised that being the case. But I said, well, that's the breaks of the game. Business is business. And, you know, he who has the gold makes the rules. And I guess they've got the gold and they're making the rules. And so I was on Sunday morning after he'd had his meeting with them. And the following Tuesday, he called me from Tampa, Florida, or the environs, Leesburg, I think it was. Close to Tampa, he called me up and he said, guess what? This morning, I just got a call from Boston. And in the conversation, they said, where can we buy gold coin to pay you with? I said, engravers are in shorter supply than they had originally estimated. Now, there's a big advantage to getting paid in gold coin, and there's a similar advantage to paying people with gold coin and learning how to use gold coin and learning why gold coin was taken out of circulation with House Joint Resolution 192 is quite a story. That was back in 1933. And then President Johnson came along, and he put a little insult to injury there with the Coinage Act of 1964 by introducing clad coinage into our circulation, our coin circulation, back in 1965. There's a story that goes along with that. But here's the moral to this story. Remember this. He who has the gold makes the rules. And a guy that has labor or skill or ingenuity has the gold. Labor, skill, and ingenuity are gold. And there's people out there that want to buy it. Always tuck that one away in your heart and remember it. Hey, I'm about out of time here, children. Let me get my paper out here and remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.